Hello and welcome. This is Hector Postigo from Temple University and the co-founder of Culture Digitally with Tarleton Gillespie. And we are back again for another edition of Culture Digitally, the podcast. It's my pleasure today to have two really interesting video games study scholars. I'll introduce them in a second. And just to, before we do that, just extend an apology for the minor hiatus that we've had with our podcast, given we had a nice influx of other type of content move through the website, and also we had the holidays. But now that we're back, we should have a number of podcasts coming up for you. So if you're tuning in again, thanks very much. Today we have T.L. Taylor. T.L. Taylor is a sociologist who specializes in researching the culture of gaming and online communities, in particular esports, massively multiplayer online games such as EverQuest and World of Warcraft. She is the author most recently of Raising the Stakes, Esports and the Professionalization of Computer Gaming, and of course the classic in game studies, Play Between Worlds, Exploring Online Game Culture, both from the MIT Press. She is an associate professor at MIT's Comparative Media Studies program. Recently, she's just wrapped up a visiting scholar stay at Microsoft Research New England in Cambridge, so we're really happy to have her here. We also have Casey O'Donnell, who is an assistant professor in telecommunication, information studies, and media at Michigan State University. Casey has authored a number of articles in game studies. Besides being a computer programmer, he is also an anthropologist and has a forthcoming book called Developers in the Mist from MIT Press. The book is an ethnographic account of global game development from a science and technology studies perspective, and it's a really welcome addition to the corpus of game studies literature out there. I welcome you both. If you could please introduce yourselves so our listenership could recognize your voice during the chat, that would be great. Welcome to you both.
I'm T.L. Taylor at MIT in the Comparative Media Studies program.
My name is Casey O'Donnell. I'm an assistant professor at Michigan State University in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences and the Telecommunication Information Studies and Media Department.
Great. Thank you for joining us in one of our conversation episodes where we get to informally chat about emerging issues in our field of study. And our listenership gets to tune in and listen to us and see where things are headed and leave comments and their thoughts. Today we're here to discuss some emerging issues in game studies, especially as they relate to ideas of cultural production, as increasingly large numbers of people come to consume digital content, in this case, digital games. What we could maybe begin doing or begin our conversation by having both TL and Casey, tell us a little bit more about their ongoing work. I said something about it in the introduction, but maybe you both can expand a little bit more. TL's been just completed that book on esports and is taking off on other topics related to esports, specifically Twitch TV. And obviously Casey also finished recent work on ethnographic research on the global game development industry and its structure and the kinds of meanings that emerge among the communities of developers that he studied. Tia, why don't you get us kicked off and then we'll get going. Just as a quick informational for our listeners, I'll be putting links in the description of this podcast to a previous work that you all have done, your books or your articles, and also in the case of TL, previous podcast that she has had with comparative media studies at MIT talking about esports, and because we're going to be referencing that work quite a bit in this conversation, I think, and it'll be nice for our listeners to sort of go back to that and see where you're coming from. All right.
So I'm a sociologist, a qualitative sociologist, and I study game culture in a variety of different aspects. So this recent book that I just finished is on the professionalization of computer gaming, a domain that's often called esports. And so these are folks, people who are playing computer games competitively for money. And so I look at everything from the players to sort of the industry that's emerging around that. And then most recently, I've just started a new project on live streaming, which is the live online broadcast of computer gaming, both people's everyday play, but also large-scale competitions. So the work on esports is continuing. I'm also looking at people's everyday play as they're sharing it online.
My work broadly, like TL's, is qualitative. I'm an anthropologist of game development. I like to look at how people make games, what they do. I've been mostly focused on how game developers do their work, how they collaborate. My first book, which is titled Developers in the Mist, and that work focused really explicitly on the AAA game industry and the broader social, political, economic context that that work unfolds in. One of the things that I was really interested in was during that research, there was a lot of upheaval as far as concerns around quality of life.
Okay, so one of the themes that I think runs across a lot of our work is this idea of professional, right? TL, in your book, and then also I think in your book, there's this really strong sort of bringing out the idea that that gaming is now this entirely different thing, right? It's now a professional endeavor, right? And that there are all these, there's a culture for it, but also an infrastructure that exists, right? A technological and our organizational infrastructure. For Casey, he's looking at that infrastructure, I think, across national boundaries, right? The idea of a work life, more traditionally situated within an organizational context, but nonetheless, there are these similarities. So I was wondering, one of the things, and for me, it's the idea of how leisure, right? Something that is typically conceived as a leisure practice, gaming, has sort of leaks into more professional, right? The processes, the architectures by which those things are made possible, both social and technological. So maybe what we could start talking about is, what is the experience of, maybe start with TL and then move on to Casey, what is this experience of work? What is it, what have you seen in your research where these gamers are actually, what's the boundary between that leisure, the play, and the professional in your experience?
I think it's great you put two key terms on the table, not simply work, but leisure. So for me, when I'm looking at the stuff happening in professional esports, and I actually make this linkage in the book, for me, that interest actually originated in the MMO space. So my first book was on an MMO called EverQuest, and one of the chapters in that book recounts a type of player that is often called a power gamer, a very instrumental, highly focused gamer, the kind of people that are sometimes now talked about as min-maxers. And one of the things that I was really interested in at the time were people who were playing in ways that for many of us didn't look like leisure. It looked like work. And so my interest in the esports players actually originates from that. What is it? You know, how do we understand play that doesn't look like leisure to most of us? And so the esports stuff led me to people who were in some ways upping the ante because they were actually transforming their leisure into, you know, something that they could make a living at, hopefully, you know, this kind of professionalized play. One of the things I'm glad you use that word leisure, though, is because one of the pieces of literature I encountered when I was doing the esports work is this stuff about serious leisure, which is from Stebbins. And I think serious leisure is really an interesting anchor to try to understand that between space, you know, people who dedicate a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of energy, build a lot of community around something that is somewhere between a casual hobby and something else. And one of the things that I wrangle with in my stuff on esports is the boundary line actually between those two categories, serious leisure and work. I think for some people, they've transformed their play into an actual professional, sustainable identity. There are other people for whom it looks something more like serious leisure. So, I mean, I think it's actually quite hard to draw a firm boundary. I think, Hector, some of your own work, you know, on the YouTube stuff, which is tracking out how people go back and forth about when something becomes money generating, how, you know, how they understand it in terms of their leisure. I think it's quite a hard line to draw, but for me, the serious leisure and work boundary is an interesting kind of space to understand a little bit more.
That's great. And one of the things that I'm coming at it from is from my research of the last 2.5 years on Call of Duty players, what you would call serious gamers, who are recording their gameplay and putting it on YouTube and then putting voiceover onto that gameplay and commenting, or what they say is called commentating on that gameplay. And to me, the boundaries between that leisure practice of playing the game, because these are, after all, people who have regular lives, right? Their primary four sources of income are whatever kinds of jobs that they have, that they then spend significant amounts of time afterwards in their hobby, which is gaming, and recording their gameplay and then putting it on YouTube. And there are these processes of transition between when that practice is a leisure practice and when it becomes something else entirely, and what constitutes or what forces shape that, or what experiences shape that.
To me, it's kind of structural, right? Mm-hmm. So there's these structural markers, right? Because what's interesting is, you know, you hear the narratives of I enjoy what I do, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the work-life thing. I enjoy work, or I enjoy these hobbies. But at some point, there are some reference that people use, some structural boundaries or some structural markers that people use to sort of define when a line has been crossed. And they go back and forth. It's not like, oh, once I've crossed this line, I can't go back. But it's sort of like teasing out what are those markers, right? That, and how are those markers generated, right? To give people a reference point of where they are in their experience. Are they at a leisure experience, or has something happened that now it's not so much leisure, now it's serious leisure maybe, and then has something else happened and now this is a job, right? And those markers are socially constructed, right? Like, and technological, I think, as well. Casey, for you, it's actually a different setting. It's actually a professional setting in which people are actually there in the workspace. So I wonder, in your experience with developers, I've always heard developers say, you know, I got into developing because I love games. And then you get into the grind of what being a game developer, a game designer is. So how does that, what are the boundaries? How does that happen in game development?
Yeah, that boundary is really interesting, because in some ways there's this real history of game development work as non-work, as leisure, right? So even historically, if you look back at early game development, it came out of, you know, it was stuff that computer scientists were doing in their free time. They were making games because they got tired of doing the other stuff that was actual work. So game development itself even sort of has this history, and game developers will talk about that they have a nostalgia for this idea of, you know, working in a garage or working in a basement for the love of it rather than this other thing. And so there is this real ambiguity, and I would say it's actually gotten worse in recent years, that mythology, because the rise of independent game development, where a lot of game developers have either been let go because of this shifting technological and political economic context that is the game industry, because it's actually had a lot of upheaval in the last few years that I wish my book had been able to engage with that. And I would say it's part of my more recent work is how the game industry is changing. And it's changing in ways that harken back to that, that are trying to refine some of that. Maybe it's serious leisure, right? Maybe that's a good way to think about the rise of it. Independent game development as game developers leaving a system where it really is just work and beginning to think about it as serious leisure. Maybe that's a useful way to think. But the game developers will often talk about this tension between loving their work and hating it. And Hector, I'm kind of like you. I don't know if there are structural markers, but I think of it in terms of the structure, the context that it plays out within is one of the key things that transitions it from leisure or serious leisure to work, and that professional identity that rises up around it. The idea that there even is sort of a mainstream game developer professional identity is one that I've really had trouble with, because having talked to enough game developers and seen enough game studios, and now talking to serious game developers as well as independent game developers, I don't get a sense of a professional identity. And in a lot of ways, the structure of the game industry really discourages a unified kind of professional identity, because that's something that people could rally around. But it doesn't, I don't think it really exists in that concrete way that some people have thought about it.
I think one thing though too is, in the same way that I think we need better understandings of the experience of leisure, I think sometimes, you know, what people understand as work is also quite complex, right? So, you know, when you, in my experience, you know, when you're talking to professional players, or you're talking to people who are doing commentating, or when you're talking to people engaged in what are expressive, creative, performative activities, which I think gaming often is, and perhaps that's a provocative argument in and of itself, but I think often is, I think then actually the language of work becomes quite tricky, and I'm sure this is not unique to that category of activity. I mean, anybody who's engaged in creative, expressive, performative professions probably has a complex relationship to what it means to labor and the pleasures of labor. I think we, you know, we often don't understand the pleasures of play, and we perhaps don't understand the pleasures of labor and all the complexity it has.
Has it come up in your work, the idea of passion, right? Do people talk about
passion? Passion is the anchor point.
It's a really complex thing, right? Because right, passion is both constructive and destructive, right? Like it has a potentiality for excess in I think really important ways, and especially when it's tied to economic structures that can quite easily exploit that passion. Right, and it's different from when maybe it's not any different, right? I mean, the passionate artist or the creative worker, you know, they're channeling those passions, but I mean, I think just like any passionate endeavor or activity where somebody can really sort of become engaged in ways, it can be potentially destructive simply because it's so they're so enraptured with it, right?
I mean, I would say, go ahead, Hector.
No, go ahead, finish your thought.
No, I was just going to say, my experience of esports and probably even perhaps high-end MMO play is that passion as a rhetorical device, passion as a ideological marker, it actually becomes the thing that's meant to signal authentic experience rather than instrumentalized labor.
Mm-hmm.
So you have passionate engagement that, and to me this is always what's quite interesting but also methodologically challenging, to the outside looks often like very instrumental labor, but the inside experience of it is passionate, authentic engagement. And I actually think that's why I say it's a very tricky methodological issue too, right? How do we understand that stuff from the inside out?
And it has to do with the subject position, right? So one man or woman's labor is another one's pleasure,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's all these really interesting constructs, right? Regarding, for example, class, right? So for example, mm-hmm, the leisure class, or, you know, gardens, right? But but to some, that's actual difficult manual labor. But some, right? So. Mm-hmm. But to the leisure class, it's a hobby in which they spend their entire weekend sort of digging ditches, right? While right? So it seems like the idea that one person's labor is another person's leisure has something to do with that idea of where the boundaries exist, right? They're pretty subjective. One of the things I wanted to sort of tease out from these conversations, I think this is great, is the idea of a few things. First, the idea of independence. Then the idea of passionate labor. And then maybe we could talk a little bit more about leisure, right? The experience of leisure as how we understand that. But let's begin with independence, because I think this is a really interesting overlap between both of your work and even some of the stuff I've been doing on YouTube. For TL, you talk about in your work on the Twitch TV folks, right? And I'll put a link in the description to this podcast so that people can visit that. I hope that's okay.
Yeah.
So people can watch that. This idea of going free agent, right? Mm-hmm. Which is this idea that these professional players are now entities unto themselves and their content is valuable enough, right? Now look how we're talking about this content, which is really their play or practice, right? Is valuable enough for Twitch TV to allow them to be a revenue generating entity, right? Which allows them to be independent from associated professional teams and sponsorship. So there's this idea of independence, right? Mm-hmm. For Casey, this idea of the game development going indie, right? Some game developers go indie, and then there's something qualitatively better about independence. would you agree that there is that there in the narratives, at least, there's this qualitatively betterness to being independent?
So, I mean, in the case of the esports players, I have to preface this by saying this is a super on the fly emergent thing, and very much I think an experiment we're watching unfold. So the majority, I would say, of esports players are still either looking for contracts with teams or hold contracts with teams, in part because they still need those contracts for a variety of reasons. But what is interesting is, the handful of players who are now, by virtue of the infrastructure provided by this new streaming technology, being allowed to experiment with going independent. And I don't know where that's going to lead. I don't know how sustainable that is. I don't know how it scales. You know, a lot of things, especially in esports, it's all about if it can scale. Maybe right. One team can pull it off, or one or two players, but can many? But it is interesting to me to see players experiment with that form of new online media as a way of, in some ways, harnessing their own brand outside of a team system.
In what you've experienced, is there sort of a qualitative discourse that says independent is better, that they're sort of falling out of, because independence? No,
yeah,
right?
I don't think so. Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, I'm actually not sure that is mirrored in the esports scene.
Okay.
I'd have to think about it a little bit more. In part, this is also because esports is still struggling with its own attempts to legitimize its activity, right? So, and part of the way esports has legitimized its activities is by anchoring in sports. That's a metaphor.
Right.
Yeah. So the power of teams, the power of team branding, what teams can bring is still pretty important. Team fanship is still a thing. So I don't know if we've yet seen this notion of the independent player as a virtuous actor in the same way you see it pop up in other indie movies, indie games, indie music, all those other places where indie somehow means more authentic or something.
Or free of some sort of institutional fetters. I guess what I'm so I'll show my hand, is like when I did this thing with the YouTube commentators, the call. So my thing is, like, I've spent a lot of time following YouTube commentators who do voiceovers on Call of Duty gameplay,
mm-hmm.
right? And it could range anything from tips and tricks, right? Which might mirror some of the commentating that you see in esports, although esports is, I think, a lot more sort of like sports commentating. But this is sort of like, hey, if you want to do better at this game, here's some of the things you can do. To write down to the video blog, right? Like to a vlog where they just talk about what happened, their truck, right? I bought a truck today and I make these amounts of payments and things of that nature. But one of the things that's really interesting is that even though there's all this interesting content that doesn't necessarily have to do anything with the game, right? Sometimes, most of the time it does, but sometimes not, that there are these associations, institutional associations that are, and what I mean by independence is that they're not, these folks aren't free agents, right? They have contracts with machinima.com, right? And so their content is cycled through machinima.com or YouTube, or they have contracts with YouTube, their partners, right? And so there is this notion of independence, and then all of a sudden there's this organizational dependence, right? And so there's this really interesting narrative about the freedom that a commentator had to play whatever game they wanted to. And you talk about this in your Twitch TV YouTube piece, right? And then having to play a particular game because the audience demands it. And if they don't play that game, they're going to lose subscribers, they're going to lose views and lose revenue, right? So even though there's this idea of dependence, independence, there's always this sort of connection to a to being bound by something. The other thing is the idea that people are independent independent of creative pressures. Again, their creativity is sort of circumscribed in a lot of ways by what the audience demands, what YouTube will, what they can sell on YouTube. So it's almost like, but then you get to this magic sweet spot where if you have enough subscribers, over a million, and some of them do, right, on YouTube, well, then they can quit Machinima. So I've actually traced, right? So I've actually seen like commentators go from 20,000 subscribers to over a million, to 500,000 subscribers. They get the most coveted Machinima.com contract and they become quote unquote directors. Then they get to a million subscribers and they quit Machinima and go solo, right?
Yeah.
So it's this sort of cycle.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I was reading your piece, I was actually thinking about how it feels like how the community you've been studying thinks about things like independence, authenticity, integrity, legitimacy is actually perhaps slightly different than how I think it operates in esports, which is, if that's true, it's nothing else than a good reminder that there is no single game culture, which is, I sort of feel like the thing that really needs to be on the table in the coming year or two, because I'm a little bit worried sometimes we get kind of this idea there's one game culture, right? And there's actually many different game cultures at work. And so I think in the esports scene, one of the things that's happened is, you know, a lot of the people who've been working in that scene for a decade, you know, underpaid, you know, to use all the keywords we've already discussed, you know, passionate, labors of love, you know, all of those keywords. In that scene, I think finally getting recognition, finally getting a living wage, finally getting professionalized payment and sponsorships and advertising, all of that is seen as good. Of course, there's some debates about which sponsors. But in general, I think there's been such a quest for stability, legitimacy, and people just being able to finally make a living. And I don't know if that's one difference with your group. I think the folks that I'm studying at the professional end of competitive gaming are interesting, and really this is their, you know, a lot of them want it to be their core professional identity that they make a living at. And I don't know if that's, is that the same for your group? And if not, then the arguments around these things may look slightly different.
Yeah, and I think, and we're going to segue into Casey's experience, because I think Casey's experience is more of an organizational, right? So what's happening when the professional identity, be that a gamer or a game developer, is fully embedded in an organizational context? What I hear you saying, TL, is that at least for the esports people, the insertion into an organizational structure, right, being paid, being all this, is good, meaning that it creates stability and identity, right? For the YouTube folks that I study, it is good and bad. They have to do all this negotiating of why it's good, sure, and justifying, yeah, and because the audience is still very unruly and they don't have that architecture or structure of esports, right? Of these organizations, they have YouTube, which is like kind of a free for all, mm-hmm, right? You get a partner, but in Casey's case, right, you have developers, right, people who are working in a passionate labor, who are embedded, who come from an embedded system and then are going into a different embedded system. So I'm wondering what kind of work those organizations do for game developers. In other words, what is the organizational structure of independence for the game developers that creates sort of an identity shift?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to hear you talk about that, TL, because in some ways, I see parallels between how for a long time, game developers really quite similarly struggled for legitimacy, for, you know, avenues by which to get their stuff out there. I mean, there was that a real similar, any legitimacy was better than none, which they felt like they enjoyed for a long time. But more recently, I think one of the things that's emerged around this idea of independence is the idea of the craft of game development, a concern for something different or above and beyond just making games or just producing games that show up on stores or show up for download. And of course, the ironic part of it is that, I mean, and Hector, I think you kind of indexed this too, is the idea of independence is sort of instantly under question, right? Because even the independent game developer is putting their stuff on the iOS store, which is not independent, right? Like, none of this occurs truly independently. There are always structures that they're working within. And I'm not sure why it, because at least in the game industry right now, there is an interest in, and I think a view that what indie game developers are doing is different or interesting or better than the mainstream game industry. I think there is that perspective. but I would say that the people working in that space, I'm not going to say that, this really goes back to what you were saying as far as subject position is concerned, that as game developers get older and their subject position changes, their relationship with those broader systems changes, right? So it's easy to be independent, or maybe it's not easy. The subject position or experience of independence is different when these folks are 35 and have two kids, or they're 40 and have two kids, than when they're 23 and they don't have that same subject position. You know, and so they talk about passion quite differently. A lot of older game developers talk about passion very differently from young folks. And I think they're kind of acutely aware that sometimes what are you passionate about? Is it just making any game, or is it making a very particular thing? If you look at something like the indie game film, which is about three independent game developers, it's quite clear that I don't think their quality of – I think some game developers' quality of life is quite – even the independent game developers' quality of life suffers in ways quite similar to those that are on the inside. And so – it's not an answer, but I think the reason it's been viewed so positively is because of an attention to this idea of the craft of game development and as something that exceeds that profession.
Right. I don't want to oversell, you know, the argument that everybody, you know, everybody wants to be on teams, and team life in esports is terrific. I mean, part of the reason you do see some people starting to spin off to doing independent stuff is the frustration with teams over the years, and in part because esports has had that very hybrid identity. So you get teams that arise that actually aren't handled very professionally, or, you know, players aren't treated as well as they can be. So I, you know, I, sort of drawing a chart of where things sit happily in terms of a formal structure, I I wouldn't put esports on the, like, everybody's happy to be in a team. There's lots of disaffection out there, but there's that tension between, you know, wanting to sort of legitimize and then retain some control over your own work life in some sense.
Okay, so what maybe we could switch maybe to one last topic that I've, or common thread, and then we'll wrap it up. So the idea, let's talk about platforms, right? Because it is a theme. I think it's a theme for all of us who are working on games, but also more broadly who are thinking about digital technologies and culture. So what is it about the platforms, the various platforms that we, that this content moves through, right, that creates the kinds of social dynamics that you, I'm not trying to be deterministic, but that, I guess better term would be to frames the dynamics and is impacted by the dynamics that you guys see, the social things that you see. So for example, TL talks about this idea of the expansion of the couch space, right? So if you think of a platform as, let's say, the Xbox, well, that's one way to think of a platform, but there's another platform, right? There's the couch, right? Or the living room, right? So how are the couch platform, right, and the social space in that platform integrating, creating, right, with the technological platform? For Casey's development, right, independence and the iOS platform, right? How are those platforms interacting with the practice of development, of meaning, right, of what it means to be independent if we want to return to independence? But let's maybe want to focus on the impact of the platform. For me, it would be the YouTube platform as a venue, or the capture card as a platform. But let's focus on you guys right now and see if you guys can think about that.
I would probably, not surprisingly, tweak it a little bit, because I think one of the things I find most interesting about a space like Twitch, at least right now, and Twitch is a really new site, so who knows where it'll be in a year or something, is actually the heterogeneity at work. Because while Twitch is itself a platform, people are coming to it with very different contexts of use and very different subcultures of use. So you can see how the pro players are using the space as cross-branded media with sponsorship and, you know, broadcasting everything from actual, you know, everything from actual tournaments are getting broadcast to practice time, all the way down to people who are using that space as I say in the talk, kind of extension of their couch. It's, they're hanging out there and there's maybe 0 to 3 people in their channel and they're, right, you know, talking to them, and there's, you know, their Twitch channel page lists all the games that they have, and you can tell them, you know, which game you want to see them play or play along. So for me, the heterogeneity of the space reminds us that we should be a little cautious about overstating what the platform does. That said, it certainly extends private play space to a public, right? Whether that's the pro player practicing or the, you know, casual everyday user sharing their play online.
Right. And one of the other things maybe I could sort of add to that is the idea of plasticity in platform. Mm-hmm. So again, not to be deterministic, right? But at the same time, to think about that there were designers sitting around in a room once upon a time with very specific ideas, right? About what would happen in that platform.
I'm really glad you mentioned this, actually, because I was literally just before we got on this conversation watching an hour-long interview that came out with one of the guys who founded Twitch. He was originally one of the guys who founded Justin TV. And he describes in that interview an incredibly elaborate process in which they went out to the people who were using their site at the time for gaming and people who were no longer using their site and asked them what they needed and wanted. And right. Really kind of, I mean, it's a really interesting description of this, you know, trying to bring in an imagined user base and figuring out what it is they would need in a site. And he's actually pretty upfront about how, you know, they couldn't imagine everything that was needed and they had to lean on their users and what their users were doing to help develop that in tandem.
Right, and it's the user-centered design philosophy, right?
Yeah.
Which is pretty strong. I think it's a strong philosophy in a lot of venues, right? And I guess I'm always torn about sort of because I see the dynamics of because there's always going to be newcomers into an existing platform, right? Mm-hmm. So there's always going to be someone who wasn't there when the design decision was made, and so there is sort of this. You know, Langdon Winner was my advisor in graduate school. So there's this sort of very strong politics of technology thing.
Absolutely.
And so there is sort of this idea that there might be a little bit of reverse adaptation.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like a little bit of like...
But isn't it the tricky part, though, is... I don't know. Gaming space, and by space now, I mean everything from the sofa you're sitting on to the room you're in to the computer you're at to the controller in your hand. That is an amazingly complex assemblage.
Right.
And for me, it just becomes very, very difficult to try to parse down the effect of any single component of the assemblage. I can only, for me, all, and I'm modest, too modest in my ambition, but the best we can do is try to map the situated assemblages at any given moment. But I mean, so how do we talk about the determinacy of a given slice of that assemblage, a platform? I think it's quite hard.
Well, and TL, so, you know, I think that speaks to exactly the question. Maybe I wasn't as pointed as that at Foundation of Digital Games, right? That question of, well, where is the platform?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've observed is that maybe at one time, right, there was this moment where there was plasticity, but so often anymore, all of these platforms are sort of continually being redesigned and reshaped and updated and flashed. And so even that plasticity becomes shifting over time, right? That the platform changes in ways and even our expectations in those relationships. So, you know, even in couch space, right? So let's talk, I'm going to talk about iOS for a second. So iPhone, iPod, iPad, .. that a lot of players expect free to play, right? And that additional content that a developer gets paid later. They have to prove their game worthy before somebody will spend that 99 cents rather than any other model. And so the platform shapes and shifts, right? So the addition of paid for downloadable content shifted the platform in ways that had, you know, it didn't manifest right away, but 2 years later, suddenly it's an expectation that that's how it's going to work.
I don't know. This is where, though, for me, okay, so there's two points I want to make. This is, for me, where I start feeling the limits of game studies / game culture. I think, you know, free-to-play exists in a broader cultural moment of digital music, BitTorrent. I mean, there's all of these other things happening in the culture that I think intersect that. And I think you're right. It's important to look at how a given device sets up or participates, I would say, in that conversation. But I think that's a broader cultural conversation that doesn't originate in any single device.
Right.
That said, I really want to be careful here because in all my work and in the esports book, I do spend a lot of time thinking about how technologies shape or at least participate in the shaping of play. But I just think it becomes really difficult to then try to, for me at least, definitively, you know, here's the start point, here's the cause point, here's the originator of that trajectory. That's for me the move I usually can't make. But I'm very with you on, you know, let's figure out how the technologies become actors in these moments, moments of our play, moments of our work, moments of, you know, whatever it is.
Well, I mean, that brings us to agency, right? And you've talked about this before. I've seen your work, right? So this idea of is the technology now an agent with, you know, within the game space, within the play experience, right? So you talked about the mods in WoW, for example, and how they change, right? They, you know, they're like a third person or another player that's providing a different kind of information, but it's a different game with that mod. It's a different player in there. And I think what I'm trying to do when I think about platforms, and I sort of pose this question to you and others, you know, this idea, is the idea that, you know, can modesty is good, and I think we're all modest, right, with our approaches to what we claim is the case in any given system that we study, game development, game spaces, whatever. But also, when maybe there is a space, some room for us to take sort of a leaps, right, and say, okay, well, what would this space look like? What would this activity look like if some designer hadn't imagined a user, right, that would do X? You know, the user does something. It may not be exactly what the designer imagined, but it's almost like an approximation of, right? So it's the plot problem of epistemology, right? We're not entirely present of reality, right? So we cannot know it as it is, right? It's always mediated, right? So whatever body of knowledge we have is at best an approximation of what is the case, whatever it may be. But maybe that's the same thing that's happening in these design spaces where, well, okay, we imagined the user and we imagined behavior. We tried to create a space where that user would execute X behavior. We know it's not gonna happen, right? But we're going to try to approximate. And I think the key for me is not to say that technology was designed this way and therefore the user behaved this other way, but rather technology was designed with an intent and the user, through their own approach to that technology, may or may not have approximated that intent. And what did the designer do when that happened, right? Did the designer go back and say, no, 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 shame on you, and then put technological regulations in place that would prevent the user from going in that direction? Or did the designer embrace those transgressions, right? And then design, make the technology plastic enough to accommodate them and ultimately work with them, right? So I guess that's, to me, that's ultimately the question of determinism is not so much did technology translate into a particular behavior, but what was the conversation that happened?
So for me, what I can do is look at my field work and see what I see. And so I absolutely agree, you know, technologies are agents and actors and quite powerful at times, but they're not, they are spoken back to and they are agreed with at times. You know, there's the kind of complex range of, they are social actors in the scene. And one of the things that I was really struck in the esports scene, and I write about this in the book, is the way, you know, that high-end competitive play space is still one in which computation is not the final arbiter of play and performance. So you find people working around, working against systems, dealing with broken systems, dealing with fallible systems, dealing with systems that can't fully express the community's understanding of beautiful play. And so they come up with alternate rule sets, or they come up with rule sets that handle that. So it's not that the technology doesn't play an important part, but it is just contingent. You know, it is only one component in the mix, and sometimes it has a stronger voice than others. But I'm not sure we can know that at the outset.
Yeah, I think and I totally agree with that. I think it's an exercise in observing a process, right?
Yeah.
Well, so it's kind of interesting. I mean, and Teal, I actually draw, you mentioned it at the very beginning, this idea of the power gamer. And that's been a really powerful figure for me in thinking about game developers, right? Because that idea that, I mean, so you also called them min-maxers, right? And they probably are they would somebody who's a min-maxer be problematic in the professional gamer space, right? Where you said some of those other rule sets have been imposed, because would the power gamer be frowned on sometimes?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a complicated question. I'd have to think about it more. I think if power gamer in the sense of meaning somebody who's very focused and instrumental in their play, I think that's a very resonant stance with professional gamers.
Mm-hmm. Because the reason I ask is just because so working with game developers, I get a real strong identification with power gamers, not because they are, but because they use that instrumental sort of logic to tease out platforms. Mm-hmm. And so I probably maybe unduly so, I pay a lot of attention to the platform because, mm-hmm. because my subjects do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so so it's really interesting that, I actually see it as a really fascinating, right? Because you see so much of the users struggling with and talking back to the platforms. Mm-hmm. And I look at the developers talking to the platforms and sort of teasing them out. It's really, I think we're looking at it from two directions, and ultimately there's a real overlap where they come together between the mm-hmm. two. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's also thinking about the way platforms are another speaker in the in the broader cultural conversation. And so, you know, Hector, you put on the table earlier the issue of intellectual property. And for me, that's one place where, you know, when I think about moments where I want to up the ante on how a platform speaks right. or how a platform has agency, we see platforms often intersect the domain of intellectual property in really complex ways. And for me, that's when they are participating in a broader cultural conversation. It's not that when, you know, it's not that when I download that game and it's DRM'd or it's checking my username to see if I posted something on the forum and then the game company's going to ban me from right. using the game. Like those, yeah. to me, those platform abilities are in conversation with a broader critical cultural moment. Do you know what I mean? So it's not, we can't simply parse them out as a technological artifact. They're an artifact that speak culturally or socially.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Go ahead, Casey. I'm sorry.
Oh, I theorize about it sort of as part of a hegemonic conversation, right? That the technologies themselves are enacting ideas about what society and culture should or ought to be, right? That,
mm-hmm. Well, I think it's interesting using the word hegemonic, because I think one of the things that I certainly tried to write through with the esports stuff is this tension between the ways in which technological actors play a really certainly important role in shaping how play emerges and is conducted, and yet they are incredibly they are non-totalizing. They break constantly, they are imperfect, they are they are flawed systems, and so despite the power they have, they also have these incredible gap moments. And I don't know, maybe, you know, my eye is always attuned to those a little bit, so it's my own, you know, whatever. Our eyes turn different, you know, we notice different things in our field work. But,
right,
yeah.
I think what you might be pointing to is sort of the elegance of serendipity, right?
Yes, yeah.
Right? It's that in those moments that weren't planned, when things break down, right? Mm-hmm. There's a certain elegant, it's a certain, that those are the times that are, well, I mean, I think both times when things are working just fine is really interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. But also, right, Thomas Kuhn, right? When yeah. things, that's the whole point, yeah. right? When things are really working just fine. Yeah. That's the really interesting part. And when things break down, well, that's yeah. also interesting, right? But it's actually the conversation, that space that creates for serendipity, for exploration, for that elegant moment that we call maybe pleasure. that we call discovery, that we call flow, whatever it is that happens in the moment when maybe things are working just fine and then they break down and you see something new. Mm-hmm. But the platforms are imperfect, ultimately, mm-hmm. right? They're not totalizing systems, like you said. So there is this space. But even in those spaces, this is the idea, right, of emergence, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where like, okay, the puzzle was to do X, Y, and Z, but lo and behold, the gamer did something entirely unexpected, used all the rules, right? Mm-hmm. But solved the puzzle in a way that was emergent. It never was planned, and it was so I think those are the moments, both in play, in our organizations, in our conversations with technology, I think that we're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I would tie it back to some language, at least I put on the table early, which is I think this is one of our interesting challenges, is understanding the relationship between computation and expressive human action. I don't know if you, Henry Lowood has written beautifully about the performance of play and those moments in which players actually can dazzle us. He's written about, for example, Grubby, a high-end esports player. Mm-hmm. And I think when I was looking at the esports scene, this is still something I'm trying to work through in my own head, is how do we understand expressive, creative, performative action in computational systems in a way that accounts for technological actors but also continues to account for human. And now I want to also emphasize it's the interrelation between them, right? It's not just parsing out figuring out what all the little puzzle pieces are, but actually figuring out the interrelation.
Right. Yeah. So I tell students the story about, well, so regardless of your feelings of God of War, but right. So, but people sort of point to God of War as a moment where the PS2 came into its own. It was this moment where people played differently in an interesting way, right? And Teal, it's that you say it quite nicely, and I'm going to have to go read Henry's piece now, where somebody plays creatively with a system in a way that results in something quite different. And we look at it and we go, wow, that was amazing, right? And it was totally within the rules. It was totally within the system, but it was unexpected and creative and interesting.
Well, and again, I think it's the thing with computer games. They are, you know, computer gameplay is only situated in very complex assemblages. So, you know, the fact that Counter-Strike is still being played, how long after it was released, but part of what's happening too, you know, monitors change, domestic spaces change, internet, and there's all these other parts of the puzzle that change that then reshape the experience of play in interesting ways.
And how we read that play too. I mean, that mm-hmm. was when I started, and I've only posted the first post, but I have two more in my reflections on Diablo 3, right? That talk about a system that's moved over 15 years and this new context and systems that break, right? or people, mm-hmm. how users are unruly and react quite violently to systems that they don't like. So that's one of the reasons why I think for the first time, Diablo 3 was a moment where I, as a user, sort of returned my attention as a player rather than a developer or a designer.
Well, I think it's a good point, because just one last follow-up on this is, you know, okay, so that list I just gave, you know, monitors change, you know, your network infrastructure changes, maybe even your domestic space. But the other thing, at least I saw and heard about in the esports scene, is, you know, what is considered beautiful or expert play also changes. Mm. So it's not just the technologies or the infrastructures, the materiality. Taste changes, right? Taste evolves. Strategies that were once deemed innovative and beautiful are now seen as passé and hackneyed. And new ones emerge within the same, you know, set of other contexts. So it's also the way in which play itself changes over time in terms of the preferences of play and what's considered good play or elegant play or even fair play.
Right. So we're going to begin wrapping up. But one of the last things I wanted to, because when it's really interesting, because you said, you know, Counter-Strike is still being played, and how long after its release, right? How many years? And immediately I thought, chess is also still being played. how many years after its release, right? So it's, you're right, right? So these games exist in a social space where things like beauty, elegance, what constitutes as prowess, right, shifts over time, but also endures, right? So like, I think of chess, right? I'm a chess aficionado, sorta, and I'm a big fan of the skewer, right, on chess. Like, when that happens, I'm like, really, I think that's beautiful. I don't care if it happens to me or if I execute it on someone else.
Yeah,
I think it's elegant, right, when they can pull that off. It's not a big deal, but I like it. And I think maybe these things are also emerging in all kinds of play, in all kinds of systems where people come together with a set of rules, right? You imagine that the rules are confining, but people in their ever amazing complexity find ways to use the rules in new ways that appear beautiful, right? Objectively.
Yeah. Well,
subjectively so. So I think you guys are right in pointing out to this idea of this tension, right? And maybe it, between the computational, right, and then the experiential within the computational system. And to me, when I hear computational, I think the rules, right?
Mm-hmm.
The rules. These are the right, but it is a great tension.
Yeah, and I think just to put a cherry on it, perhaps at least in relation to things like YouTube or live streaming, I remember once being at a tournament and asking a player. There's a move in Counter-Strike where you can sort of always be hunched down and kind of squatting, running around. Mm-hmm. And there's often tournament rules limiting its use. And I remember asking a player once about this, well, why is that? It's, you know, it's clearly allowed in the game. And he said, well, it'd be really ugly to watch and look at if you sort of watched a whole game of people doing that. And I think there's something interesting to think about, too, how, you know, the context for our play also are probably going to shape our understandings of what counts as beautiful or elegant play, and perhaps then in turn of Casey's work, and as designers think about that, what they design as beautiful or elegant play, you know, if you're sharing your play with more people, does that change, you know, what gets counted as good play or what, you know, you want to share? So I think these, you know, platforms like YouTube, live streaming, those also have the potential of reshaping the culture of play in interesting ways.
Okay, on that note, I think we have to close. I just want to thank T.L. Taylor and Casey O'Donnell for spending a nice hour having this really great conversation on what we are with game studies in some of our thinking, and some of the really interesting questions that pertain to science and technology studies, to game studies, generally speaking, as well. And that bring not only our research together, but I think other kinds of research that are out there that try to look at video games and their place in our society as both a leisure practice, but also something that we engage in much more differently than just leisure, sometimes even with a work mentality. And also the practice of making games, and how making games for developers is not unlike playing games, right? It's not, doesn't lack that kind of passion. So I do want to thank you both. This is the Culture Digitally podcast. We are doing one of our episodes called Conversations, and we thank you for coming. My name is Hector Postigo from Temple University, bringing you once again one of these conversations, and I hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you very much for listening.